Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com. Join Josh and Chuck, the guys who bring you stuff you should know, as they take a trip around the world to help you get smarter in a topsy-turvy economy. Check out the all-new Super Stuff Guide to the Economy from HowStuffWorks.com, available now exclusively on iTunes.
Hello there, everybody. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette. I'm an editor here at HowStuffWorks.com, and sitting next to me, as always, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
See ya!
Well, that was quick.
No, it's Hungarian for hello.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying goodbye.
Not yet.
All right.
I don't know. I'm kind of in a fog right now.
All right. Well, today we have another one of our famous, or soon-to-be famous,
listener mail roundup jamborees.
Yeehaw.
I think this would be number two.
Yep.
So let's get started, shall we?
Sure.
All right, so here's the first one.
Okay.
Hi, guys. Currently listening to your April Fool's podcast. So I'm so sorry this is taking so long for me to get to. Great stuff. I think my favorite podcast so far was your 2008 Christmas picks. I didn't see anything from this listener in my stocking, but okay, thanks. On a more serious note, I work for a small coffee roaster in the Midwest, and I think we almost got involved in an online scam. Someone emailed a request asking if we shipped to South Korea and specified a freight company we should use for a quote. I did an internet search and found this person's name and email on a website highlighting online scams. I checked out HowStuffWorks.com, excellent choice, and skimmed the article on how online fraud alerts work, but didn't see anything about how to report potential scam activity. I went to the IC3 website, but we didn't suffer a financial loss, so I didn't know if I should fill out a complaint. Wow, can't talk. Do you have any suggestions? Thanks for all your awesome, informative podcasts. I've learned I'm a techie at heart. Sarah. Well, Sarah, we can give you some hints and some tips if you suspect that you've encountered an online fraud. Actually, there are quite a few different opportunities you could take. It all depends on sort of the nature of what the fraud is. But your first assumption to go to IC3, that's actually a pretty good one. IC3 stands for the Internet Crime Complaint Center, and it's a partnership between the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the National White Collar Crime Center. And usually that's a pretty good source to go to if you need to report an online scam.
Yeah, they're very specialized toward internet crime, as the name suggests. Unlike other agencies. So it would be very helpful. They also have, if you are interested and are not Sarah, they also have a lot of other scam information on the website. So even if you have not been specifically targeted, but are interested in scams, you can find a lot of information about different stuff that's going on right now, different styles of scams, specifics on what to do with regard to filling out a complaint.
Right.
The thing is, if you haven't actually been scammed, it's kind of, I don't know what they'll actually do if you fill out
a
complaint.
Well, I mean, you can fill out a complaint and theoretically they're going to investigate it. And if they find there's anything substantive there, then they will proceed.
Right.
I don't think that you necessarily have to suffer a loss for them to be aware of it. I think it's better that you go ahead and say, this is who I think is trying to defraud me. This is why I think that. Here is some supporting evidence. I mean, you don't want to just throw accusations around.
Right, right. You have to send, some information about who they are and what you think they were up to. And, if you actually, go ahead with it and send them information or send them money, they're going to want to know exactly what you did and when it happened and all that information. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult for them to investigate it further. But,
yeah.
They're going to want to know specifics, in as much detail as you can give them to them.
That's true. And, if that seems like that's not the right course for you, I've got some other suggestions you can follow.
Okay.
If the business that you suspect is committing fraud, or the individual who's committing fraud is either in the United States or Canada, you can contact the Better Business Bureau. if it's outside of that, that's outside of their jurisdiction. So that would not work in that case. Other opportunities, you could contact the Federal Trade Commission. That's good for fraudulent emails or fraudulent businesses. The Attorney General, if it's a fraudulent business. There's the eConsumer.gov website is a good place to go if it's an international company that you suspect is committing fraud. So that's of course one of the big problems with the internet. You know, it's a global entity.
Sure.
So not all the sites or all the companies are going to be found in the United States, which makes it a lot more difficult when you're like, well, what can we even do about this? If they're on the other side of the world, can we even prosecute anything, you know, any sort of fraud? But you can go to, like I said, eConsumer.gov and at least report scams. If nothing else, it can raise awareness. For phishing emails, you can use the US-CERT, which is the Computer Emergency Response Team website, to report that. You can report fraud to the FBI. Mm-hmm. You know, this sounds like it's really kind of scary, spooky stuff, but really we're talking about people's lives can be ruined by fraud.
True.
And it happens all the time. And it's better to go ahead and report something than to stay quiet about it and just hope that, you know, no one else gets hurt. Like, you know, we'll eat this loss and we'll just, you know, we don't want to suffer the embarrassment of admitting that this happened, or, you know, we don't want to go through the paperwork. That's really kind of irresponsible. It's much better to go ahead and step forward and say, hey, these guys over here are taking people for whatever they can, and we need to stop it. And then there's a www.fraud.org, which is the National Consumer League's Fraud Center. That's not a government site. That is a nonprofit consumer site. It's actually one of the oldest ones that exist. And they have a lot of information about fraud, how to spot it, how to avoid it, how to report it. And you can report something to that center and they will take it from there. They'll actually start going through and say, okay, these are the authorities we should contact. Here's the information that we have to pass along to them. So that's a good resource too. Now, I know that we tend to concentrate a lot on the United States, so I actually looked into a couple of other opportunities as well.
Okay.
So for my friends up in Canada who are still mad that I said that they don't use 911, I just mean that you guys don't have emergencies because you're so level-headed. No, seriously, right. I know now that you use 911. At the time, I wasn't sure, and I couldn't get to my computer, so I apologize profusely. Please stop throwing bacon at me. But in Canada, you can, again, contact the Better Business Bureau or Industry Canada Consumer Connection, which is an I followed by three Cs. Do you think that causes any confusion?
There are lots of
IC3s.
Yeah. I found that out.
And then over in the UK, you can contact the Metropolitan Police or the Office of Fair Trading, or you can go to a website, www.ripofftipoff.net, to report scams. And there are many other organizations you can contact. And of course, those are just two other countries. Every country has different departments that you can contact in the case of scams. And a good resource to go to for really any person in any country is www.consumerfraudreporting.org. They actually maintain a list of various countries and the department that you would need to contact if you were to encounter fraud online.
And it seems, Sarah, that your instincts were good because you knew something fishy was going on. And, I know it's been said many, many, many times, and it's sort of cliched now, but, yeah, if something seems too good to be true, it probably is.
Yes.
So, you know, trust your gut feeling when somebody offers you something, that seems a little out of the ordinary, you know, as far as a business proposition. I would imagine that, you know, businesses have to, you know, you're looking for every opportunity to do more business, you know, versus, hello, beneficiary, I want to, trade, you know, trade your information.
Hello, Mr. So-and-so.
Yeah,
I am a lawyer for Mr. So-and-so, who is sick in Nigeria.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sure for business, it's got to be a little tougher because you're looking for an opportunity to actually, you know, conclude a deal. But, you know, you got to trust those instincts because if something smells a little fishy, you need to look into it, even if you don't bite. And it's, you know, let people know.
And I encountered a lot of this back when I worked at a different job. I was, I manned the phones every now and then. And occasionally we would get the phone version of this kind of scam someone asks you a couple of questions, and just by saying yes, they go ahead and put down that the client agreed to this service, and then they start charging you for it. And people are like, why are we getting charged for this paper from this vendor? We don't even use this vendor. Mm-hmm. And it was all based off of this one phone call where they trick someone into saying yes. And that is the basis of their agreement.
Right.
It's pretty scummy stuff. And, you find it in all walks of life. It's just the internet makes it
so much easier.
Yeah. Cause you can then scam people all the way across the world.
That's great.
You aren't limited to the people in your area code. Thank you, internet.
Isn't tech great?
It sure is. Moving on.
Okay.
So our next question comes from Eric, and Eric wanted to know the difference between the terms hardware, software, and firmware. We talked a little bit about firmware in a previous episode, and he was just kind of curious as to, what exactly is firmware? So really you have to talk about all three to kind of explain. So first let's tackle hardware.
Well, that's pretty easy.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to tackle it first.
Those are, in the case of electronics and technology, the machines themselves.
The physical devices.
Your monitor, your computer, your iPod,
your printer,
phone,
adapter cards,
fax machine,
cables.
Yep. Anything
mouse.
Like that. If you can touch it, technology, it's hardware.
Right.
So that's pretty easy.
And then software are programs and applications that run on hardware. So this is like all the different programs, things that you rely on day to day. Operating systems can be, that's software as well.
Sure.
So this is, the little happy programs that make your technology useful. So it could be anything from like software on computers, software on a mobile device, even on some watches, things like that. I mean, pretty much any electronic device that can do a sophisticated sort of task, it's using some sort of software.
So the hardware is the machine that without the software, it couldn't do anything.
Right.
So the software is the program that runs on the machine and gets it to do things.
What is firmware?
Yes.
It's kind of, firmware is this gray area that, there's no definitive point where you can say this is firmware and this is software, right?
Well, it's sort of a combination. It's literally a combination of the two, but only for a very specific part of the hardware and a very specific part of the software.
Yeah, and these tend to be very tiny applications that are hard-coded into some part of the hardware on your device.
Sort of like a driver.
Yeah,
really.
It could be very much like a driver, or a microprocessor has machine code coded onto it. Otherwise, it can't work. When you're running a program, ultimately it's getting translated into machine code and then translated back into whatever the program's doing.
Right.
But that's the very core of how a computer works. So the firmware is the stuff that is hard-coded part of the device. You can't remove it. You can't write over it. It's what allows software to communicate with the hardware so that you get results.
Yeah. It's actually stored in ROM, which is read only memory. And, so it can only be found on a ROM that's inside of your machine. So it's not something that's on your hard drive or anything like that. It would actually be in the chips themselves.
Right. You could think of things like, would you call, say, a cartridge game, would you call that firmware because it's hard-coded onto the cartridge?
Well, that's a really good question that I don't have an excellent answer for. You mean like an Atari 2600 cartridge?
Yes. Don't say the game.
I'm not.
Okay.
But those were those cartridges, those older game cartridges up until, I guess Nintendo 64 era type stuff. Those you can't write to those cartridges.
Right.
And I mean, you can, but you have to have a burner to do it, and it's a pain in the neck. You're putting it inside your game machine. You're not writing to them. Those are ROMs.
So I guess you could kind of call them firmware.
Yeah,
they're kind of fit in that area.
I think though that people would tell you if we went to talk to a programming expert, they would say that something inside the 2600 on the chips itself that tell the chips how to handle that would actually be firmware, where the software is on the actual.
Fair enough. Cartridge. So what about a ROM chip that you would find in an old fashioned arcade game?
See, now that I'm thinking would probably be technically firmware.
There you go.
Somebody's going to write to us and tell us we're
email
wrong.
To Paulette. So, yeah. Just make sure you put attention, Paulette.
So, now, yes, if you would like to clarify our position, you know, we're not programmers.
But that's the thing is that really firmware is kind of, it's a little bit of a fuzzy term because there are some points where you might say, well, is a driver really firmware or is that software? Because drivers are what allow, you know, devices to interact with programs.
Well, this goes back to our semi-definition that we're making up as we go along, which is if you download a driver for your printer, you're storing it on your hard drive. Right. It's software on your hard drive that your computer hardware uses to access the printer.
Right.
But say you have to update the firmware in your wireless router. And that way, you know, you're having to download information that gets stored, written back onto the router to make it, you know, do what it needs to do to interact with your computer and stuff.
Eric, I'd like to thank you for breaking tech stuff.
Well,
I'm very much impressed.
You know, I will admit, you know, hey, I didn't really know everything about firmware. I still don't, but I know a lot more now from doing research to answer this question.
Yeah,
so if you have
yeah.
a clarification and want to help out, if you're a programmer expert, you know, please drop us a line and tell us
what's
going on.
And it may very well be that certain, you know, within different industries, you have different definitions of what this really means. I mean,
that's true. I was using a general tech dictionary to get information.
Because someone might think of firmware one way for, say, a laptop and a different way of thinking about when you're talking about, say, a mobile phone or an Xbox 360. I mean, you know, we have game consoles now that get firmware updates to correct for problems. So, you know, this is no longer just the realm of the computer.
Yeah.
It's really lots of different devices.
But it's essentially chip instructions versus the software that actually runs, you know, when you open a program on your machine.
So thanks a lot, Eric. Hope that muddied up the waters a little bit.
I know it did for me.
Yeah. Yay. Well, we have one more. Ready for the last one?
Okay, I'm ready.
All right. Hey, guys. I'm a new listener, but have only 6 more of your podcasts to listen to.
You're getting caught up quick.
Yeah, caught up really quickly. I can't get enough information, so thanks. On your Rechargeable Batteries podcast, I was hoping you'd address one aspect of charging. The scenario is I've been playing on my iTouch all night, and I realize it's getting late and I need to charge it so I can take it with me tomorrow and have enough battery to last the day. But if I plug it in now and leave it in all night, I'm worried I'll overcharge the battery. So my question is, can you overcharge batteries? Thanks for your help, Aaron. All right, Aaron. Well, so we're talking about rechargeable batteries, whether, you know, we talked a lot about what was the best way to charge them, you know, how charge is lost over the duration of the lifetime of the battery, that kind of thing. You remember this podcast?
I do remember that podcast.
So overcharging. First of all, you asked, can you overcharge batteries? The answer to that is sometimes.
Well, the answer to that is yes, but it's very difficult to do it because depending on the kind of battery you have and depending on the machine you're using to charge it, it's unlikely that you're going to do that. Because most chargers have some technology built in to keep you from overcharging your battery.
Yeah, it'll detect how much voltage your battery is storing, and if it's over a certain amount, it'll stop sending a charge to that battery.
Essentially, laptop batteries are pretty smart in that regard.
Yeah.
Because they generally have some technology built in to say, oh, this is enough. You don't need to charge anymore.
So let's just say, for sake of argument, that your charger, the voltmeter no longer accurately measures the voltage in your battery.
And that's a problem.
Yeah.
Capital P problem.
So let's say that you've kept the device, computer, whatever, plugged in for like a day. What's the worst thing that can happen? Okay, so the best thing that can happen is that your battery overheats a bit and it damages the battery and your battery life suffers as a result.
And that's probably going to be the most common thing that happens.
Yeah, that's
like by and large the most
best
common
case thing. Scenario. Worst case scenario. The battery bursts into flames and burns down half of Detroit, even if you lived in St. Louis. No, that's a bit of an exaggeration. No, it really could, though. It could burst into flames. I mean, that is a possibility. It's not likely to happen.
No.
But it is a potential danger that every lithium-ion battery really has. It's that if you overcharge it, it might burn up.
Actually, you make a good point, because I forgot to mention that the research that I did was specifically for lithium-ion batteries, which is the most common battery found in laptops and portable electronics, you know, rechargeable stuff now. There are other kinds of rechargeable batteries, so your mileage may vary.
Yeah, some the nickel battery is actually a little more dangerous, I think. But the
nickel-cadmium?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're not used as much as they used to be either. And lithium-ion also has you've seen those laptops that have burst into flames. That's called thermal runaway.
Seen them.
And
I had one.
Well, it
didn't burst into flames. It just got, it got extremely hot.
And that can actually happen by itself when you're not charging.
Yeah.
But, that requires a serious breakdown in the battery itself too.
Yeah. We're talking about chemical reactions that kind of cause this stuff to happen.
That's unrelated to the charging. Well, I guess
overcharging. Yeah. So anyway, yes, it is possible. It's not easy to do. So you probably don't need to worry about it, but in general, don't leave anything plugged in for 24 hours.
Yeah. If you read the instructions that come with your portable electronic device, computer, et cetera, you'll get instructions, and a lot of them will tell you, yeah, go ahead and plug it in and charge it overnight for the first time. Or, you know, I think if you come home, your batteries run down, you plug it into the charger, and then the next morning before you leave, you unplug it. I don't think that's going to cause a big problem.
No.
It's when you leave it plugged in for days and days and days and days and days, especially when it's something that's less intelligent. Like if you just had batteries sitting at home in a charger and they were just, well, you know, I'll leave them in there so they're always ready. Well,
that's
probably not a good
idea.
Leaving your laptop plugged in all the time is not probably going to cause a big problem, because it's a little smarter than that.
Yeah. So in general, you're probably okay. Don't leave your devices plugged in for 24 hours or more at a time. Just avoid that, because that can cause damage. Even if it doesn't damage the battery directly, it might wear the charger down faster. I mean,
or the battery.
Yeah, or the battery. That's true. The battery life can suffer if it overheats for an extended period of time. That can cause the chemical reactions to be less efficient, and then it doesn't hold as much of a charge as it used to.
And that's a simple way to tell. Feel it.
If it's warm,
if the battery's
that's
warm,
a bad
that's
sign.
A sign.
Yeah.
If it's a little warm, that's kind of warm. If you go, wow, that's pretty darn warm.
If you're using a device like, I don't know, the HTC G1 Google Android phone, if you're using like that with all of its functions going, it can warm up all on its own. So that's not necessarily a sign of the battery overheating.
Yeah.
That's a sign of the processor getting really hot. I found that out the hard way. Now I don't use nearly as many functions at a time.
Well, I use, my laptop at home is an Apple aluminum case laptop, and then there's that, working in the summer wearing shorts thing going, wow, that is awfully warm.
Wow.
So that's, use your head, but if you feel your battery and it's warmer than it should be while it's charging, and, for example, you're not actually doing anything with the battery, it's just plugged in, that's a bad sign.
So that about wraps it up for this podcast, I think. You don't have anything else to add?
Nope.
So if any of you have any questions or concerns, or you want to try and get something off your chest, like the image of Chris in shorts working on a laptop, if you want to get that, out there, just go ahead and send us an email, techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Remember, we've got blogs up. You can access those from our homepage, howstuffworks.com. And we have articles about all these sort of subjects there, too. Check them out, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?